Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest.
Have you started thinking about your summer goals? Are you hoping for some accountability to help you stay motivated through the summer heat? Join Author Accelerator in the hashtag AmWritingPodcast for a free weekly writing challenge. The 2022 Summer Blueprint Button the Chair Challenge will include 10 episodes hosted by certified book coaches Jenny Nash and KJ Dell'Antonia. In each episode, Jenny and KJ will give you an actionable step to take to further along your manuscript or revision. You can also sign up for weekly reminder emails to help you stay on track. Each episode will include interviews with other experts across the publishing industry about their writing journeys, all to keep you inspired, motivated, and ready to write all summer long. Learn more and sign up for the challenge by visiting authoraccelerator.com/writing. That's authoraccelerator.com/writing.
Welcome everyone to the episode entitled Books with Hooks, our favorite segment. We are so thrilled to have authors with us today. Today we are welcoming Caroline, and Caroline is here to tell us about her book and read her query. So Caroline, I will turn it over to you.
Okay, here goes. Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, if I'm ever found unconscious in my local park, my obsession with your podcast will be to blame. I walk my lab puppy while listening to the podcast, and when I hear an especially inspiring piece of advice, type the information in my notes app, ignoring where we're walking. So far, my dog has run me into a fence, a ditch, and countless tree branches. I may not survive. In any case, I would like to submit Vanilla Camilla for your consideration. It's an 83,000-word romantic comedy, and for our heroine, Campbell Cam Thompson, it's the nickname she despises, although I'm pretty sure she'd love the book. It combines the identity swap of the Parent Trap with the workplace romance of the Hating Game. Cam was first called Vanilla Camilla a decade ago because she and her flamboyant college roommate Camilla look like carbon copies. But Cam is the boring, practical version. Insulting nickname aside, the two have used their doppelganger appearance to switch places everywhere from traffic court to bad first dates. But this time is different. This time, their identity swap on the island of Vieques, Puerto Rico, has given Cam everything she's ever wanted. Her dream job running a hotel boutique, a budding fashion line, and maybe love. Too bad it's all based on a big fat lie. She's not Camilla King, impetuous hotel heiress. She's Campbell Thompson, the cautious sidekick who always has a backup plan. Just not this time. In her guise as the boss's daughter, Cam and her co-worker, Marcos Flores, are thrown together to prepare the hotel's theme for the Virgen del Carmen Festival, squabbling and sparking their way through a series of romantic adventures, from horseback riding to boating to floating on a bioluminescent bay. Her identity swap wasn't such a problem when Cam thought her co-worker was an uptight jerk, but now that she knows the real Marcos, the kind, funny, sexy one, she knows that he could never love a liar. When she is forced to admit her con, Marcos swears off Cam, and Camilla's father swears he will disinherit his daughter. But Cam discovers a much bigger lie, a secret plot to wreck the hotel and lure the staff to an abandoned bombing range for the party of the year. Cam will have to convince Marcos and everyone she's deceived to believe in her again or risk losing the hotel and possibly their lives. I wrote this book as a love letter to the people and places of Vieques, from its wild horses to the glowing Mosquito Bay, with a nod to the island's dangerous history as a bombing range for the U.S. Navy. This is the first of two planned books. The second, The Campbell Preamble, tells the story of Camilla masquerading as Cam while she chases love around the Middle Eastern island of Bahrain. This is my first novel after a lifetime of reporting from natural disasters, war zones, and Capitol Hill. I now work part-time as a TV news reporter and full-time as a mom and Marine wife. I have ghostwritten 8 romance books, 2 that are sweet and 6 that are spicy. Vanilla Camilla falls right in the saucy middle. Thank you for your time, Caroline.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Caroline. First of all, this opening is so cute. We're so glad that you listen to us while you walk. So many people listen while they walk. So we have such a good community there. And I love the title. Vanilla Camilla is just like absolutely adorable, catchy, memorable, which is so important with a title. Memorability is like the most important thing. So I absolutely loved the title. Okay, so now to the comps. So I think with The Parent Trap, it feels a bit dated for me because I was kind of going through and thinking of other comps for you. Have you read The Holiday Swap? That one is 2 twins and they switch places. One is, it's like a bakery thing where it's like one's a baker in a small town, one's like a TV chef, and like then they switch places. So I would probably be using The Holiday Swap as a comp. And the other thing is, I would also be using The Holiday Swap cover copy as a model for how you should probably lay this out. They're dual POV. I get the sense that you're just single POV, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. That one's dual POV. But I think that will help you kind of figure this out, because you know the kind of the hook of that one says a feel-good holiday-themed romantic comedy about identical twins who switch lives in the days leading up to Christmas. Again, yours aren't twins, yours isn't Christmas, right? But we can kind of use that as a kind of backdrop. So yours would be something like, another comp I was thinking was Jane the Virgin, because that's a hotel in Miami and there's that love story element there as well. So I thought a romantic comedy for fans of Jane the Virgin in The Holiday Swap, look like roommates switch lives running a boutique hotel or something like that, or hotel boutique. I mixed up my words there, you know? So just whenever we can find templates that exist in the world, we can reuse them and remodel them for ourselves. So that would be something where, you know, let that kind of be your guide. So now I'm kind of coming back to our two Camillas. And I also think that will kind of help explain that these two are roommates and they're both named Camilla, because you don't actually anywhere kind of flat out say these are two people named Camilla, really. I didn't, like, you kind of allude to it, but never, you don't like spell it out anywhere. So I would just make sure that's super clear. But the other thing is, so you get this, Cam is the boring, practical version. And whenever you call your character boring, I think, well, why is it that you want us, the reader, to follow along on this character's journey if you're calling her boring, right? So I would try to find another way to kind of find some redeeming qualities. And I know you're just trying to compare and contrast them. Obviously, I get that. But for the sake of the pitch, just try to figure out a little bit more energetic way to describe her to kind of really get our attention there. All right. So the formatting here. So you have a pretty long query letter in terms of like there's a lot of line breaks, paragraph breaks, and that sort of thing. There's a couple reasons why I think we should just like pull this all into one paragraph. One of them is your formatting is probably going to get messed up at some point, right? Because it looks so neat and tidy in a Word doc, and then you have to like put it in an email. Formatting can get so wonky with email. So you're not going to want to do indentation. You're going to want to like keep it flat, you know, the line without that indentation. Keep it all flat because it'll just be so much cleaner when you're copying, pasting, and prepping everything for the actual submissions. Again, it looks tidy in Word, but it can get messy there. And overall, it's just too long. I made a number of notes. You know, you'll get my notes here, but like what I think we can kind of cut, you know, the extra stuff like horseback riding to boating to floating on a bioluminescent bay, all lovely, but just like, I just don't think we need it in the query letter. I think what we really need to focus on is the identity swap. Why her? Why this character? Why we're following her and not the other one and not the other Camilla? And what I really think shines in this query letter is how jam-packed this third act is, because you have this whole like, you know, the con, and then she has to, once she's kind of, everything's been revealed, then she has to go back and then convince everybody about, you know, why to get on board with her. So I think your third act is so rich, and I think that's one of the things that actually sets this book apart, is that, you know, we get a lot of pitches for things that don't have a rich third act like this. So again, so I think that's really well done. So I would just try to like comb out some stuff out of the middle, make sure we just pay attention to things that we really do need. I question whether we need a couple things. I question whether we need this. I wrote this book as a love letter paragraph, and this is the first of two planned books. As much as I love that bit about, you know, why you love the people in the places, it is word count that's just being used that is cluttering the page a little bit. So unless there's a way that we can weave it into your author bio, I would just take that out as a paragraph. And then the first of two planned books, I would probably take that out as well, because, you know, again, you can have a conversation with an agent about this later on. Of course, it's, you know, it's fine to be writing other things, but I really want to focus on this book. And again, because it's kind of long, I would probably just be focusing on this. It does kind of explain like the story of the other Camilla, because this is one Camilla's and that's going to be the other Camilla's. But I don't know, I still somehow think we need to really focus on selling this book itself. So those are all my notes. Feel free to, you know, come at me and ask me any questions.
I wondered about I had heard you guys say, never say, and this is part of my 7-part series. So I wondered if you'd tell me to ditch the Campbell preamble. The reason I brought it in there, and now saying out loud, I realize I'm just to catch people's interests, but I wrote it specifically so it would line up with the same time period of Camilla being in Bahrain. So the phone conversations, and I'll repeat them in the next book, but if I'm just trying to get your interest, then yeah, so I could ditch that, and I could absolutely come up with different words for boring.
Was there anything in particular, you know, you had notes on with my feedback? Is it single POV? It's single POV, right? Like, we don't get the male POV?
Right. Yes. So do I need to straight up say in there single POV?
I don't think so necessarily. Yeah, I don't think so. But if it was dual, I would say that and make sure you say it's dual.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, definitely not dual. And so you like the last part. And so I'll take up Vieques isn't like another character in the book, but it's a big part of it. But you think I can just say it? I don't need to talk about the sexy adventures they have.
I don't think so, because ultimately the pitch, we really have to focus on the high notes of the pitch here. And even though it's a character, so you say up here, it's like, this time their identity swap on the island of Vieques, Puerto Rico, like right away we are getting an island vibe. Do you know what I mean? Just by saying it's an island. So sometimes we don't need to like repeat anything too many times in our query letter. Just one time is enough. You know, there is an element of understanding, I think, just with even just saying, you know, it's an island, it's Puerto Rico, that sort of thing.
Right. Do I need to put in there, it's a romance, but it's also her finding herself by being in another person's shoes. So she's, you know, straight-laced and always follow the rules. And then she's put in the situation where she has no financial consequences. So, but she figures out she doesn't want to be the old Cam, but she doesn't want to be Campbell either. Do I need to talk about her personal journey, or is it enough just to touch the romance part?
I think the romance is the hook, but I think that kind of answers my question about Cam, because when I said Cam is the boring practical version, right? I think understanding a little bit more about Cam, because other than the fact that she, you know, she gets to swap lives, we don't fully understand until we kind of get to the pages, which is like she's lost everything in terms of like her job and her boyfriend and everything like that, about why she needs somewhere to stay. That's obviously really important. But yeah, I think understanding a little bit more about her is important. And so when you swap out the boring practical stuff, I would talk about some of those reasons. Don't dwell on them. Like, again, try to just be really conscious of your word choice, economy of words, economy of space. And I would use the holiday swap as a nice kind of framework for focusing on what is the most interesting thing about this book. It's the swap, and it's the romance, and it's this third act, I think, from what you're pitching me. So like, that's what I would be focusing on. All right, we need to switch it over to our pages now. So would you want to give our listeners a little rundown of what you wrote about?
You got it. All right. So chapter one starts with Cam walking down the street with her wonky old suitcase. Her boyfriend had dumped her. He owns the apartment, so he kicked her out. She shows up at work, and the fashion house where she works is going under. So worst day ever. She's meeting her best friend, Camilla, at this bar that's in a hotel, their place. She texts her and says, worst day ever. I want to tell you all about it. When they get there, they know the bellhop because this is their place. And so she's talking with the bellhop and they're watching Camilla. And Camilla's one of these people who's got that magic. Like the bartender always pays attention and the middle-aged men are giving up their seats for her. And so you sort of introduce Camilla through her eyes and they get their differences. So she walks over to Camilla and says, and they both had this terrible day. And Cam says, I have to tell about mine first. They do rock, paper, scissors. Cam wins. So she tells her about the day. Camilla is elated because she hated the boyfriend Chance. And so she's trying to, you know, high five her and cheers her. And Campbell's saying, please stop. And so they talk a little bit about Cam's terrible day. And then she says, what happened to you, Camilla? Well, Camilla's father is this hotel magnate. He has said she has floated in the 6 years since college, not doing anything to support herself. And he says, you have to come to Vieques and run this boutique. It has to turn a profit or you're done. I'm done with you. And Camilla, in her self-centered way, doesn't understand that this is the perfect dream job and her terrible day is not nearly as bad as Cam's. And so the 5 pages wrapping up with Cam saying, so the perfect job in paradise, what are you griping about?
All right. So one of the big themes here, especially in the opening pages, is, you know, fashion. She works at the fashion house, you know, the hotel boutique and everything like that. So we understand they're from a certain class and a certain world, which has such a personality to it. So one of the things that kind of I stumbled upon in the second paragraph was you just say the fashion house where I worked. And then later on, I think you just call it the fashion house again. So when you say fashion house, like to me, that means like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, like we're talking like fashion house to me is like a certain caliber of fashion. And also we would name it. You would know that your friend worked at Gucci. You wouldn't say like the fashion house, I don't think, unless they're called like the fashion house is the name of the fashion house. So I just felt like we're losing an opportunity there, I think, to get specific and just kind of know a little bit more about exactly where she worked. The other thing is if it is a fashion house, meaning like somewhere high end, it would be so shocking to me that they would go under because all of these large fashion houses are now owned by conglomerates. So yeah, anyway, that just seemed a little, my plausibility meter was just like, oh, you know, doing a little like tick, tick, tick. So that, you know, gave me pause a little bit. But I really liked that right away. It's like, we're getting into the friendship element, right? Like right away, it's like 911 text, gotta connect with my friend, right? And so I like that you're moving things along because obviously the point is like, let's get out of the situation and get to the hotel where all the drama happens. So I think you're moving it along really well. So the next thing is you say, so the bar is in a boutique hotel halfway between our Manhattan apartments. So tell me the neighborhoods. Manhattan is a really big place. So I would just really, again, like that specificity of, you know, what neighborhood are they in? Again, that will tell me something about them. You know, just trying to narrow in on all of those word choices can really add an extra layer of meaning, which I think is really important. Okay, so next, so you had them describing what each other wears. And I normally don't love that, but because this is, again, this fashion hook and this kind of explaining the type of class that they're in, I think that really worked. So I think that was totally fine. But again, you said on my feet were heels from my favorite store in Brooklyn. I would say what neighborhood in Brooklyn or what store? Again, an opportunity to get a little bit more specific there. Okay, and now we get to the breakup and how her best friend feels about her breakup. I think this is another opportunity to get really in depth about their relationship as best friends. Because if your best friend hated the guy you lived with, like that could cause a rift. There might be a lot of feelings there. I don't know whether it's like insecurity that, you know, you chose the wrong person or you're mad at your friend because she didn't like the guy, or whether you really don't care about this guy that much that you don't care whether your best friend bashes who you live with. So I felt that was a little bit of an oversimplification there. And I would just love to just really understand their friendship more. I don't care about the relationship, right? We don't care about this guy. What we care about is the friendship. So I would use that as an opportunity and a vehicle to kind of learn a bit more about your friendship. The other thing I was thinking is, why do we even need Chance? Can Chance just not exist, or does he come back? Because again, the implausibility of her you know, breaking up with her boyfriend, losing her job, like all of this stuff where she's like, oh, this is happening to me in one day. It's a lot for the reader to kind of understand. And again, plausibility, is this really all going to happen in one day? So I'm almost wondering, again, if Chance doesn't come back, I almost think Chance doesn't need to exist because there's so many other reasons that, again, her day could go wrong or she could get kicked out of her apartment. Maybe, like, I don't know, there's bed bugs and they're exterminating and her, you know, she has to be kicked out for a certain number of months, or they're renovating her flat. And, you know, again, she has to be kicked out by the landlord for a certain number of months. I just think there's a lot of things that could get her out of her apartment and into her best friend's, you know, space and obviously into this job. And he does nothing for me because that's kind of the point, right? He's like, he's a bad boyfriend. So I would honestly probably just cut him. Those are kind of my main notes. So I will turn it over to you and you can ask me anything you like.
Chance does not come back except in the one, I was trying to make the worst day ever. And you're right. That is a lot to swallow. It would happen in the real world. He is only represented later in when she's offered the fashion house job again. Two-thirds of the way of the book, she thinks of, now I'm the person Chance wanted me to be. I would be a financial success. I would have prestige. So he doesn't actually come back, just as an idea of Chance. So I think I could drop him. The only thing I talk about her trying to, she's not sure who she is. And she was trying to mold herself into what Chance wanted her to be. And that's a little bit of a personality. But if, you know, it's two paragraphs here. Mm-hmm. And I almost think
it could be like who her best friend wanted her to be. Like, I just feel like these two, if you're trying to explain the really tight bond these two have, maybe it's not even like her boyfriend. Like, she's trying to be the woman that her boyfriend wants her to be. Like, maybe she wants to be the woman her best friend wants her to be, right? Because her best friend, like, is of a certain class or, you know, has this rich family. So I think when in doubt here, I would really pull it back to this friendship. When in doubt, you know, just like make them the focal point. Because again, I think that will just increase the intensity here and also just drive intrigue into the next book if you're going to write a book about her. So that would be my note. Just, yeah, I get rid of the dude.
I can do that easily. Is it too much to say college roommates who happen to find each other are almost exactly look-alike? I didn't know how to get around it. That's the crux of it.
That was something that I didn't find implausible for some reason. Okay. I was like, that makes perfect sense to me. I don't know. That part I was totally on board for. I actually follow this Instagram account where this photographer finds people in the world and finds their doppelgangers. And it could be like one person's in Brazil, one person's in Canada, one person's in, you know, Australia, one person's in Norway or whatever. Anyway, and they find the people. And he photographs them together. Anyway, so for some reason, the doppelganger thing didn't throw me off at all. It was the other things.
Okay, cool. My other question is, so they're 28. And so for me, and I didn't live in New York, but I lived in Hoboken, which is right across the river. And for me, 28 was when I felt like a proper grown-up. Is it plausible that the Camilla character would have been screwing around for 6 years after college and never actually employed? Do they feel 28? Should I make them a little younger, a little older?
That's a really good question. I think with enough money, you can... Yeah, you can mess around for a long time and not have a job as long as you have enough money to support that venture. So there's a lot of, you know, man-child characters out there who, like, don't grow up till they're 40. So, you know, it didn't really bother me that she kind of jumps around, you know, careerless or anchorless for a while. You could make them 32. Honestly, in New York, people are, you know, single for a lot longer, you know, settle down later, that sort of thing. So you could move them into their 30s easily. I think it just depends on, you know, timelines and that sort of thing. I think that you could make them, you could definitely make them older. 20s to me, so I'm 30, I'm 34. And so to me, 20s do seem young, like but they're also like times where you can have lots of adventures and things like that. So I think knowing that they're going on a big adventure, but being New York City, again, you could move up their age and I don't think that would affect it too much.
Okay. Is Camilla likable enough? Because I wrote this one in the pandemic when I just couldn't stand looking at my four walls anymore. I needed to pretend I was in Vieques. But I also read it after Emily Giffen's Something Borrowed and then Something Blue. And it was kind of that relationship, but without the cheating and the frenemy stuff. And I want Camilla to be likable. And I want you to look at her and say, oh, she is a good person. Is she likable enough? Or is five pages not enough to know?
It's not enough to know, but also that worries me that I don't know the answer to that, because I feel like I should kind of know within five pages a little bit more about her, I think. So that's why I think, you know, I pointed out those opportunities, like, you know, how she feels about her friend hating her boyfriend, like any opportunity you can, I think, to add some layers and depth. I would like to I would want to know more than I do know, I think.
Okay, so by ditching Chance, having it through Camilla's eyes and more in the relationship, you'd get a better flavor for who she is. Okay, that makes sense.
Any last questions before we part?
I can't think of a thing. We'll hang up and I'll have 100. But no, this was amazingly helpful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. So I'll email you over all of my notes so you'll have those in front of you. I know it's overwhelming to get them all, you know, told to you. So you'll have them all in hand. And yeah, I wish you the best of luck with this. I love that you spent your pandemic writing, and so many other people did as well. And we'll have so many other listeners that can relate to that sense of escapism. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Caroline.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. All right. Well, second author joining us today is Sammy. Welcome, Sammy. Will you kick us off by reading your query letter?
Well, thanks so much for having me today. Dear Miss Lyra, I am seeking critique and representation for my first novel, The Unfortunate Life of Genevieve Ryder, a 95,000-word completed work of historical women's fiction. I've learned so much from you, Carly, and Bianca during the Books with Hooks segment of The Shit No One Tells You About Writing and your generous advice on Instagram. I'm sending this query to you because of your love for flawed protagonists, secrets, and the dynamics of female friendship. In the vein of The Language of Flowers by Vanessa Diffenbach and Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng, The Unfortunate Life of Genevieve Ryder is one woman's quest to live her life against the backdrop of the quiet desperation of the 1950s and has themes that will resonate with the modern reader. It's 1946, and 22-year-old Genevieve Ryder knows that the only way out from under her mother's domineering thumb is to get married. Bobby McFadden is her perfect match, but when Jen realizes she's pregnant and learns Bobby is engaged to someone else, the life she had planned is over. Forced to spend a year at Bethany House, a home for unwed mothers, Jen decides to keep her baby against the wishes of her mother. Forward-thinking staff and an unlikely friend empower Jen with the skills necessary to build her own life on her own terms. When her time at Bethany is over, Jen must forge a path for her and her daughter, Catherine, in a world that only wants women to keep house and raise babies for their doting husbands. Eventually, she meets and falls in love with Peter Young, but a single act of passion results in a secret that threatens to destroy the life she's fought to build. When I was growing up, I knew exactly two things about my maternal grandmother. Her last name was different than my mother's maiden name, and she divorced a man in the mid-1950s, someone who wasn't my mom's birth father, but the man she called Dad. This novel is my attempt to understand how that happened. Beta readers have had emotional responses to the story. Professionally, I play games, organize chaos, and teach truth to middle and high school students as the youth director at my local church. Personally, story is the way I move through life. Currently, I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan with my husband, 4 teenagers, 3 cats, 2 turtles, and 1 overly friendly golden retriever. Thank you for your consideration. And at the bottom, there is a trigger warning for spousal abuse and abortion.
Thank you so much for reading that great query letter for us. Extra thank you for the content notes. It's so appreciated. Okay, so here are my notes. I want to start by saying that I just love Little Fires Everywhere. I know that everyone does because it became a TV show and it's so huge now, but I was a fan from day one, and I just want to claim that because it's such a great novel. I love Celeste Ng. As we get to the plot paragraph, when I read A Single Act of Passion, I was thinking to myself, like, that can mean hot sex or murder. And I kind of want to know which one, just because it really does change the story quite a bit. So, and you know, building on that question, so far, other than the inciting incident, Genevieve's arc is internal. And so my advice to you is to do the movie trailer trick, which is essentially to, if you had to film a trailer for this, what scenes would you include after the inciting incident? And of course, you'd pick scenes that escalate the conflict, like the conflict that can be shot by a camera, not the conflict that exists in someone's head. And I'm a huge fan of interiority. So whenever I say this, it is not to suggest that you should cut the internal arc. Internal arcs are very important. But the query letter isn't telling me anything that happens plot-wise after the inciting incident. It is telling me things that are happening inside her own heart. The fact that she inhabits a world that has expectations of her that don't match her own. The fact that she makes decisions that don't fit with what people expect of her. So I am getting that. Also want to say that I really like the detail at the end where you said that this novel is your attempt to understand how that happened in your family. It's so interesting how something like a different name back in that generation typically indicates scandal, you know, or at least a juicy secret. So I think that's really interesting and just says so much about our society. Recently, I interviewed Melissa Fu for the podcast, and her wonderful novel, Peach Blossom Spring, was also an attempt at finding out more about her father's life because he wouldn't share anything with her. And I find that drawing from real life can be a really powerful starting point for historical fiction. So thank you for sharing that with us. That was really powerful. And of course, I have to very quickly say that I loved the whole, you know, how many turtles do you have, and cats and dogs, and that's just amazing. So yes, thank you. I am all for a zoo at home. That sounds great. So yeah, any questions for me about that?
Thank you. I actually have two questions. So my concern was, so I had to pitch it as historical women's fiction, right? Because it's historically set. But I couldn't find any comp titles set in the 50s that are recent. And so I'm wondering, is it okay? And The Language of Flowers is a 10-year-old novel. Readers have matched those two books, my novel and that one together. But I understand that it's a 10-year-old novel, and I can make the argument for Little Fires Everywhere, which is why I included it. But I'm not sure these are the strongest comps, and I don't know what to do because I have been looking. So is it okay to use a modern comp against a historically set book?
It would be tricky. It's okay if you must. Like, everything's okay as long as I can see how the comp would be delivering on something, and as long as I see how your book is similar to that. But it would be hard for me to see that with a modern book. So I wouldn't worry too much about the time period being exactly the same. I would worry more about the structure of the novel and the writing and, you know, the characters or whatever else. Because if you were to tell me this is like The Nightingale, but set in the Gilded Age, I understand what that means, even though they're two completely different time periods, right? Like World War II and the 1920s, I don't even know. But like two different time periods. So I would focus more on that than on the exact time period. I get your concern about the comps being old. Modern comps are ideal. I will say that I got the Little Fires Everywhere comparison. Because we're talking, like, I understood what you meant by that, because we are discussing adoption, we are discussing a familial structure, and then I kept wondering, like, who is the outsider that comes in, because that is very much what drives that book forward, and I didn't get that in yours, but I did have a question about it, which is not a bad thing, so yeah.
One other question that comes out of this is my title okay? The book, and we don't know this by this or by the five pages, but it covers like a 25-year period. So in terms of the arc, it fits. But I'm afraid that title is a turnoff.
Don't love the title. I think the title is a little bit of a downer, like The Unfortunate Life of Genevieve. Like, it's just, people don't want depressing books right now. They want uplifting, at least towards the end, like hopefully more than that. So I just don't love the title. Like, it's, being very honest here, it's a little generic, like The Unfortunate Life of, it could be anyone's name after that. So I don't know. I would pick a different title. Yeah.
Okay. I like that.
So would you please give us an overview of what happens on your first five pages?
All right. Well, first we open with a time and date stamp and a place stamp. It is November 1946 in Medford, Wisconsin. And we open with 22-year-old Genevieve Ryder daydreaming out of the window, dreaming about getting married and marrying a very specific person, Bobby McFadden. But that those daydreams are interrupted by the screech of her mother calling her to help set the table for dinner. And all through this, we're getting little clues that something isn't quite right. Genevieve's mom, Antoinette, is very angry and very upset. As they're setting the table, we see the sister, they are conversing back and forth, and we are just getting a sense that Genevieve understands that she's a disappointment, and Antoinette is very upset at her for everything she did, and Marie's just trying to be supportive. And as we go through dinner, we start to hear that there's this pressure that tonight Genevieve has to be perfect so the McFaddens will accept her. And from that, we go into the only flashback of the entire story, where she remembers coming downstairs after being sick from a couple weeks and meeting her parents in front of the fire in their rocking chairs, where she then tells them that she doesn't actually have the flu, but that she's pregnant and that Bobby is the father. And she's like, okay, so I'm going to use this as a way to get married. And her parents are incredibly disappointed and show their disappointment in different kinds of ways. And she realizes that her plan is ruined. Everything is ruined. Her life is ruined. And we come back to the dinner table where Antoinette ends it by saying that everything has to go perfect tonight. And we end this 5 pages with them welcoming Bobby and his parents to the door and welcoming them in for coffee that night.
Okay. Thank you for summarizing that for us. You did such a good job. Question before I begin my notes. You mentioned the only flashback, like your entire novel only has one flashback?
Correct. One flashback.
Okay. Okay. In that case, Sammy. And Sammy, are you a listener of the podcast?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Sammy, and then I'm going to be really hard on you. Remove the flashback. You have to remove the flashback. Like, I am so sorry, but you know this. It is a golden rule. No flashbacks on the first 5 pages. And if you must have it, why are you writing it in italics? It just totally took me out of the scene. It was jarring. It just, no, I don't think you need it. I don't think the flashback is adding anything other than detail. Detail is appreciated, but it's not needed in the first 5 pages. Cut. Be ruthless about it. I am promising you your story will be stronger for it. Okay, so that is my first note. I will go through all my notes and then you can give me your comments. So as I was reading this, I thought to myself, first and foremost, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get a scene where she's daydreaming and it's going to be so slow and boring. But that did not happen. Right away, her mom interrupted her. So great job on that. Like, great job making sure that there's disruption right on the first page and that we do get those clues that, you know, make us wonder what's going on. And then we do get lots of answers, which keep us turning the pages. So excellent job framing that. I wanted to know, does she have other siblings? Because there's a line that says, no one could measure up to her mother's exacting standards except Marie, the golden child. And I'm thinking there's only two girls, because I didn't hear about any other siblings. So if there's only two girls, just be like, because it's not first person, but, you know, Jen doesn't live up to her mother's exacting standards. And has she ever wondered why? Like, why would her mom treat the other one so different? She probably has theories. She probably has specific insecurities. As she was daydreaming, same page, you know, Genevieve couldn't help but think that she is her mom, like the simple farmer's wife she was, and that Jen never wanted to be. So the way children, teenagers, young adults, honestly, the way anyone, any human, but especially younger people work, is that when they think of their future, they try to fit it into possible templates, whether they heard about it in a movie, whether they heard about it in a book, whether they heard about it because she has an aunt who is an in-town wife. Where is she getting this inspiration? Who exactly does she want to be? Who does she admire? Who does she look up to? I love that you have her, let's just face it, looking down on her mom and being like, I don't want your life. I love that. That's believable. That tells me a lot about her character. That moves the story forward. That promises me that probably she will end up having a different life, but not in the way that she's expecting. It's great. But then who is she modeling her ideal life on? I need to know that. On the theme of her being more sophisticated, so she does set the table incorrectly, and then her mom corrects her. So I thought that doesn't add up, right? Like if she is more sophisticated, if she does pay attention to the fancy families or whatever, then maybe she could be setting the table in the more modern fashion, how people are doing it now. And then her mom could be like, that's not how you do it, because her mom is so old fashioned. So I think that would be more realistic and would develop the theme, like I said. I'm not going to talk about the flashback again because we already covered that. But yeah, remove it. Seriously, just cut it. Guillotine. Like, off with their head. Off with the flashback. So another thing I noticed is that you have this tendency to ask questions, to have her interiority repeating what was already said in question form. So Bobby was engaged so soon to Susie. We know that he's engaged to Susie. The dialogue was covering that. Better? Could it even be better? It slows down the pace. Pregnant? She was pregnant. It slows down the pace. We already know. You're just having her repeating it. Cut. This is where you must be ruthless with your own work so that we can pick up the pace. I also had questions about the authenticity of the language. So this is historical fiction. Would people say pregnant? Didn't they say with child back then? I don't actually know the answer to this, but I would look it up because I don't think people said pregnant in 1946. Could be wrong. Another thing, she says, I'm pregnant and it's Bobby's. I don't think she would specify that. It's 1946. The fact that she slept with one dude is scandalous enough. Would she tell her parents, don't worry, it's not Joe the milkman's, you know, it's... I don't think she would do that. I think she would just say, I'm pregnant. And then, you know, her dad would be like, I'm going to kill this Bobby guy. I also wanted more clues about the plan. And I have, towards the end, you have dialogue. But dialogue said by different people, it's all in one paragraph. Like, we're not getting a new paragraph per line that's being said. And in books, that's how it works. So I wouldn't do that. Just because it creates a little bit of confusion. Like, I didn't know who was speaking. This is the very last paragraph, because I can see you frowning and you're like, where is this? Maybe I misread it. My big picture note, and I will close with my big picture note, which I think I've supported with these minor line notes, is that her interiority right now seems generic. Her one thought is she wants a different kind of life than her mom, and to achieve this, she needs Bobby to marry her because she is pregnant. Now, of course, I understand that that's where her thoughts would be. I get how that's what she would be thinking of. Of course, she wouldn't be thinking of anything else. That does make sense. But in order for the reader to connect with her interiority, to the interiority of any protagonist, really, they need specificity. And it can't be thoughts that anyone would be having in that moment. They need to be really specific to her. Like I said, for example, whose life does she long for? An aunt, her friend's mom. Her best friend from school who has the perfect life and who lives in the better house. I don't know. When we could really get some sharp specifics on that. Also, was there a girl, probably there was, who already got pregnant and who was already disgraced in town? Like, you know how towns have like lore? Like, this happened to so-and-so and she was disgraced. You know, this happened to XYZ person and she had to marry, you know, and she's miserable and that's not going to happen to me. Like, I want her interiority to have more specificity, because without that, I can tell it's a draft, which is okay, because that's why we're here for. We're here to critique drafts to make everything even stronger, assuming the notes resonate with you. So now I will stop talking and it's your turn to ask questions.
First thing I want to say is that, Sammy, I'm here for moral support. Cece was so hard on you, and I'm here for you, Sammy. I'm here for you.
Thank you. So I only came to you because I need this. I'm at the space where I can't make it better without other people telling me how to make it better. So thank you. I won't cry too much. No, I'm not going to cry at all.
Don't cry at all.
I'm not going to cry at all.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to make someone cry.
No, you're not going to make me cry.
I'm going to cry with you then. We can cry together. We can have a crying. Okay. We can have a crying circle.
Okay. So my first thing would be, okay, so clearly the novel originally did not start in this space, right? Like, I cut at least 10,000 words from the beginning to have it start right here, right? And that flashback was the only thing that I felt had to be in, but I don't want to back it up because there's not enough tension to start at that spot, right? There's just, it's the tension is here. And so is that stuff that sets scenes about who those parents are and that relationship there? Without that flashback, we can't go back to that moment in any other way. Does that mean we really don't need that moment? We really don't need her coming downstairs and doing that conversation with her family in that way?
Excellent question. Really proud that you cut those 10,000 words. I think you're starting in the right place. This is exactly where you want to start. And like I said, you're framing it really well because you have this promise of a girl daydreaming and then it's like, bam, reality with disruption. So that's excellent. I don't think we need to see it at all. At all. It did not. You did such a good job of telling me that she was pregnant without telling me that she was pregnant. Her mom looking at her waist. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, her saying you've made a mess of your life, or I don't remember the exact line, but it is so subtle and so clear that I don't need that flashback. If you're concerned about whether the parents' interaction is important, then maybe there could be an interaction happening right now as she sets the table. I don't know. Like, it doesn't, I don't think that you need that specific scene to show a family's dynamics. And if you do, if you must, put it in later. Like, do not flashback in the first 5 pages. I'm not opposed to flashbacks later, just not in the first 5 pages, and especially not with italics, because then you're telling my eyes, right? Like, and remember, our eyes read hundreds of pages every day. Like, you're telling my eyes, oh, the scene that you just started getting invested in, we're going to go to another one. And I know it seems silly, but because we do read so much stuff, and especially because, honestly, Sammy, you don't need it. It's strong as is. I'm trying to think if there was anything about the way that... I do think that, you know, finding out that he's engaged was a blow. But finding out that she was pregnant was a blow, and we didn't see that. We didn't see her find out that she was with child. So it's fine. Like, you've done a good job establishing it.
Okay. And I was actually, when I was doing these five pages, I was disappointed that that was there, because the next couple of pages with the interaction with Bobby and his parents and the setup and, like, the whole rest of the setup is so great that I wish you could have read that too. Anyway, I've had a difficult time figuring out authenticity of language, figuring out how exactly there are certain things, even as we talk about in later chapters, as we talk about like furniture, how we talk about furniture or how we talk about clothes. That has been a challenge that I didn't expect as much. And if I could set it forward into a modern era, I would do that. But the story just doesn't work in a modern era.
It wouldn't make sense. No, because nobody, like, yeah, no, you need the social construct of that time.
Yeah.
I think it's honestly just about research. Like, get nonfiction books, watch documentaries. This is 46? I wonder if...
Starts in 46.
Are there any TV shows set in 46? Like... I don't know. We look those up, like documentaries, nonfiction. I remember an author once telling me that she read memoirs written by people who were alive at that time just to get the sense of the language. You know, stuff that was published a billion years ago, essentially. So that could also work. Even newspapers clippings from that time. Like, this is where you put your researcher hat on and really lean into authenticity. If you get beta readers who also understand the time period, like, I feel like your ideal beta reader would be a historian or something. That would also be kind of gold and kind of amazing. It's harder to find, but yeah, it's about research.
These are all great things. I'm pleased that, with the exception of the flashback, that the pace is good. And right, I worked really hard to trust the reader to put it all together without spelling it out for them. And I try to do that throughout the rest of things. So the fact that you caught that makes me feel warm and fuzzy inside. So yeah, this has been really, really helpful.
You did a great job with the pace. And even the flashback, it's still really well written. You just don't need it. Like you said, you were trusting the reader. You are trusting the reader in your pages. And so trust them to also get it without the flashback. That's what I would say. But like, you know, like we always say in the podcast, there's one God in this world. The God is you, because you created it. And so if you want to keep the flashback, by all means, do it. I promise you, you don't need it. I promise.
The last question I would ask is there enough emotionality in it?
Yes. I had no emotionality notes. And I always do. I'm always like, what is she feeling? And can we get a better sense? I had none of these. Like, you'll get my notes once Bianca sends those off, because you'll get to see like specific line notes, specific highlights, all the stuff I loved, because I highlight that too. We just don't spend that much time on compliments. Not because we're mean, I promise. But because what is that adding, right? Like, you need to know the stuff that I feel could become even better. But yeah, I had zero, like actually zero comments on her emotionality. So you did a really good job.
I guess I don't know. How far away is this from being ready?
37.8.
Perfect.
No, that was a joke. When people ask me this, what I always say is, this isn't a thermometer. I can't tell you where the water's going to boil. Like, it's not like, and so I always answer a random number.
I understand. That's not a fair, it's also not a fair question, right? I understand
Like, I can definitely tell you that if it weren't for the flashback, I would be like, this is almost near perfect. Because every story I read, including published stories, I can go, oh, what's happening here? Could we get more of this? Like, if you think about it, you have one, other than the flashback, you have one note, which is specify her interiority. Yes, the language thing, but you can do a pass for that at the end. Okay. You know, one thing, this is layering work. You don't have to do it all the first time around. Like, do one edits for interiority, then do one edit if you want to. Maybe you want to do a different way. But like, I don't think that you should try to tackle it all, because you'll have to wear so many different hats if you do that. So maybe you have a great chapeau collection, but I think that sounds like too much.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. You have Carly here to tell you about our upcoming The Shit No One Tells You About Writing virtual retreat. It is on September 24th and 25th, and we are so excited to bring this back to you guys again. We did it in January. We had an absolute blast and got such amazing feedback that we were so excited to be able to put together another amazing weekend. We have 18 hours of jam-packed content. We have 13 speakers. It's such an amazing, inspiring, and just community-building event filled with so many learning opportunities from authors, editors, and various speakers around the industry. We can't wait to see you guys there. Check out more on our website, and we will see you soon.
Hi, everyone. It's Cece. Question, what's the biggest difference between a book and a movie? If you listen to the podcast, you already know the answer. It's not that movies have things like special effects or soundtracks or even actors at their disposal. It's that books allow us to be inside someone's head, to experience their inner lives, which is why the ability to write a character's interiority is so important. With that in mind, I've developed a webinar called Writing Interiority, Revealing Your Character's Inner Life. Join me on August 18th via Zoom to learn all about the foundation and functions of interiority, including how to leverage interiority into plot points. We'll cover techniques on how to effectively convey a character's inner life in a way that keeps the reader turning the pages of a story, with lots of examples from some amazing books. And of course, we'll have time for a Q&A. Writers of all genres are invited to attend, as knowing how to write interiority is a superpower useful for all storytellers. For information on how to register, please head over to my Instagram or Twitter page, click on the link in my bio, and follow the instructions. And don't worry, if you're busy on August 18th, register anyway, because the class will be recorded and a recording will be sent to everyone 24 hours later. I hope to see you there.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky, though, to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of June. For more information,
and to register, go to biancamaray.com, look for the beta reader matchup page, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Today's guest is the New York Times best-selling author of 6 novels, most recently Home Before Dark and Survive the Night. His first novel, Final Girls, has been published in 30 countries and won the ITW Thriller Award for Best Hardcover Novel. His latest book, The House Across the Lake, has just been released by Dutton Books. A native of Pennsylvania, he now lives in Princeton, New Jersey. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome Riley Sager. Riley, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to chat to you. I have been a huge fan of your work since I read The Final Girls. And I actually just want to touch on that before we dive into our discussion of The House Across the Lake, which I also absolutely loved. So a question we get a lot on the podcast from emerging writers is the one surrounding pen names and the use thereof. Now, for our listeners, Riley's real name is Todd Ritter. He wrote 3 books under that name before trying a pen name for the first time in 2014, which was then Alan Finn. And then in 2017, he chose Riley Sager for The Final Girls. And this really launched his career in terms of sales, not just critical acclaim. And for our listeners, it's incredibly sad that these two things are considered separate things. You can have huge critical acclaim and not be very successful when it comes to sales. So Riley, could you take us through the thinking that you made there? Because to me, it's a very savvy move. And on this podcast, we are all about savvy moves.
Yeah, the name thing I get asked a lot, and it's very complicated. And there's a lot of different nuances involved that the average reader just doesn't understand or can wrap their heads around. And so for me, it was like 3 books under my real name, and they did not sell. It happens, you know? And so when it came time to, like, I could have written another book for my publisher at the time, and I thought, why bother? Like, it's so much work, and it's going to be the same amount of crappy sales. And so I think I need to do something different. And so I wrote a historical supernatural mystery that I loved the whole process. I loved everything about it. And I was like, oh, this is my new turn. This is my career now. And I'm so excited. The publisher basically killed it. Like it's one of these weird things where, like, they waited more than a year to, like, publish it. I had trouble with my editor, and they dumped the book on, like, December 30th with zero publicity. They didn't even send out review copies. So, like, they just literally killed this book. And so already my first pen name was just dead in the water before the book even came out. And so I wrote Final Girls as, like, this Hail Mary. It was like, this is my last ditch attempt at a writing career. And I think the desperation and anger shows in that book. And so my agent read it and she said, this is the best thing you've done so far. We need to use another pen name. And I was very reluctant. I said, I really want my name on this book. I'm so proud of this book. And she laid it out for me. She's like, okay, here's what's going to happen. We submit this book to editors under your real name. The first thing they're going to do is look at your previous sales, which were shitty. And she does not mess around. She was not messing around. And she's like, and so what's going to happen is you will get a shitty advance. They're going to slap a shitty cover on it. And then they're going to dump it into the market with no publicity. And you will be exactly where you are right now. And I knew that she was right. And so that's when I was like, okay, Riley Sager was born, basically.
And that is genius, because as an author as well, you know, my debut did okay. My second book tanked because the editor who bought it left the publishing house. Then I got another editor who was wonderful. She was lovely, but it's not the same as you loving that book and you're acquiring that book. So that book did dismally. And when, you know, and then I decided to pivot in terms of writing contemporary fantasy as opposed to literary fiction. And that's the first thing publishers did was they went and looked at the sales of my previous books. And then they were like, okay, well, at least you've changed genres. So there's that kind of thing. And for our listeners, if you watch Friends, writing is all about pivot, because you just have to. You've got to change different genres, change names, whatever is going to get the books out in front of a new audience. So my question, Riley, is if you guys went out on submission with the new name, at what point did the publisher then know that you were XYZ who'd published this? At what point did they need to know that information?
After they made an offer. And that was where my agent was just brilliant. She had the idea of like, okay, we're just going to submit this blind. I'm not saying they have to base their decision on the book and not you. And she said, it's a pen name and you will hear nothing from me unless you're interested in making an offer. And I just thought that was great because they did truly have to judge the book on its merits. And that's why when Dutton Books really, really wanted it, that's when I knew. I'm like, okay, they don't know anything about me. They just truly love this book. And so I knew that was the right home for me.
And it's so sad because that's how book sales should work. It should be. This is an amazing book. We want this book. We're going to get it out. But, you know, for our listeners, keep in mind, it is a business for publishers and you're only as good as your last book and track record is important. So these are all things to consider. Of course, I think they managed to keep it secret for a little bit in terms of your readers, Riley, because I think even on the flap copy, I remember when I read that book, there weren't even pronouns. So, and there wasn't a picture and I thought, oh, this is a woman writer. How long until you guys were kind of forced to say, okay, this is who the writer is?
Well, and in hindsight, that was a total mistake. Like, I do think my publisher's intentions at the time were very, they wanted people to respond to the book the way they responded to the book. And when we were having publicity conversations months before the book came out, they said, the book is going to be the focus, not you. And I appreciated that. But at the same time, when you have a pen name involved, people's first response is, oh, who is it? And what are they hiding? And in this case, it really seemed like the wrong thing to do because there were people at the time who were coming out and saying, oh, he's just pretending to be a woman to fool us into buying this book. And that wasn't quite the case, but I could see why people would think that. And so before the book even came out, I think like the week of release, I took part in a Wall Street Journal article about male writers writing psychological thrillers under gender neutral pen names. And I was, there was a photo shoot. They took my picture. And so like for a little bit, I became the face of men pretending to be women to fool women readers into buying their books. And it was like, it was not a good time. And so if we could go back in time 5 years, I would be like, you know what? Let's not do this. Let's just be as forthcoming as possible because you never want to be seen as trying to trick readers or being shady or secretive. And I think in some cases, like most people, know my deal. They like my books. But I do think that there's still some residual animosity about that.
And yeah, I mean, that's a huge pity. For me, I didn't care whether it was a man or a woman who wrote the book. I love the book. For me, I love a mystery. So for me, it was like, ooh, they're not using pronouns. Who is this person? And then wanting to dig deeper and find out purely to solve the mystery, because, that's the way my brain works. But certainly, yes, I could see how that might come back to bite you in the butt. And, hindsight is an exact science. You only figure out through experimentation what worked, what didn't. I think issues like the A.J. Finn sort of Mallory thing didn't help when it came to writers using pen names because that kind of muddied the waters. But anyway, thank you so much for telling us all about this. All things for our listeners to keep in mind. And honestly, this is a question we get a ton. So you've really helped demystify that. And I really, really appreciate that. Okay, so what I would like to chat about firstly is setting. The kind of settings you do phenomenally well is kind of remote settings where people are isolated. And even if it happens in the city, they're in a place that isolates them, etc. And I often speak about setting as character. And you do that phenomenally well. You did that with The Final Girls and you've done that now with The House Across the Lake. Can you explain to us the appeal of that kind of setting for you and how you go about bringing a place alive?
Well, in this case, I do agree that like setting is as important as character because I love a good setting. And sometimes, you know, it takes some work and you have to, okay, what are the good characteristics of this place for maximum suspense and what makes it creepy? What makes it interesting? And it helps that with The House Across the Lake, I based it on a lake and a lake house that I spent some time in, and it's where I got the idea for the book. And so I had a little bit of help because I got the idea while I was on vacation in Vermont, and I spent that whole week sitting like Casey does in the book on the porch in a rocking chair looking out over the water. So it was very easy for me to be like, oh, yeah, I'm right here. Like, I just described this, basically. I did, you know, change things around to make it creepier. Like, the lake I was on, slightly bigger, had a lot more houses. And so I decided to, like, okay, I want just a few houses. I want the water to be really deep and really dark. And I want it to be very, very isolated. So it's fun to come up with a place and then think about all the different ways you can shape it to build maximum suspense.
I love that approach to it because there's like this claustrophobic kind of feel, even though there's very few people and because they're isolated, but you did amp up the creepiness. And it makes me laugh how we as writers can't even go on vacation without our brains stopping with all this shit. It's just like we're in a perfectly lovely house and we're like, what happens if a murder happened in this house and whatever. So now, Riley, time to come clean. Did you pick up binoculars and spy on the neighbors?
No, because I didn't think to bring any. But I did search the lake house because it was a rental. And so, like, literally, because I sat down and I looked, like, there's this one house across the lake in particular that was beautiful and it was all lit up. And I just immediately, like, leaned in and thought, who lives there? What are they hiding? What is their life like? And I did search the lake house for binoculars.
For future vacations, you're going to be a bit smarter about bringing the binoculars. I know people in downtown Toronto who've got telescopes, you know, in their high-rise apartments, and you visit and you go, oh, I didn't know you were into stargazing. And they're like, what, stargazing? No. So you could just imagine what they're using the telescopes for. So it's pretty funny. Okay, so I also want to discuss telling versus showing, especially when it comes to the thriller genre. So for our listeners, you send in your query letters and our agents, Carly and Cece, critique them and they critique your opening pages. And something that often comes up is we're saying you need to show more, tell less. There's a place in a novel for telling, but about 30% of your novel should be telling and the rest should be showing. But it's so important in the thriller genre because something that Riley does really well is that we get shown these scenarios and he leaves it open to interpretation as to what we think is happening. And then we get an understanding of what the character thinks is happening. And it creates this tension between the reader and the book, because not only do we have tension between what the main character Casey is interpreting, we have tension with what we think is happening because we are not being told what's happening. We're being shown it and then it's up to us to try and figure it out. So Riley, can you tell us a bit about that in terms of how you approach those kinds of scenes?
Yeah, it's something I still struggle with, and it's kind of the one thing I wish I was better at is doing the showing and the not telling, because in all of my books there is like a couple points where I just have to be like, okay, I'm going to literally just sit here and tell you what's going on so far, because it just, you need to do it sometimes to just bring the plot forward. But with The House Across the Lake, I didn't quite know how to begin it. And so after it was finished, my editor requested a prologue just to establish that we're on a lake, we're at a lake house, and that the main character has been watching the house across the lake. And it was fun to write because I got to be kind of creepy. And I think the opening line of the book is, the lake is darker than a coffin with the lid shut. And so that's a line that you can come up with after having written the complete rest of the book. But the first real chapter, per se, is, you know, Casey is sitting there. There is a detective sitting across from her. And she says, you know, through the conversation, like, you understand, okay, there is a woman who's missing. Her husband is this, you know, kind of the prime suspect, and he's no longer at the house. And there's a storm coming. And I just kind of throw you in there and don't explain things, and then end this first chapter with Casey going upstairs and the prime suspect is tied up in her bed. And she says, "What did you do with Catherine?" And that was such, I was very proud of myself when I came up with that, because you don't know really, you know what the situation is, but you really do not know what the situation is. And that's the fun thing to do, is to kind of just give the reader tidbits of information and kind of make them figure it out for themselves a little bit.
Yeah. And there were parts that, you know, Casey was interpreting things in certain ways. And I was going, hold on. I wonder if it isn't this. And then you start getting frustrated with the character. You're like, why are you so fixated on this one thing? Why haven't you noticed this? Perhaps it's this, etc. So that's a wonderful tension to build in between the writer and the character, the reader, the character, the book. So it's multi-tensional in so many different ways, which is what keeps readers, you know, turning pages. And what Riley's saying is, in the opening scene, there's the detective and Casey's just happily lying. Casey even says, "You can check my house if you want to." "What, don't you believe me? Do you want to check my house?" And the cop like looks at her and is like, "No, that's fine. That's not necessary." And then Casey goes up and there is the person in the house. And you're like, "Oh, ballsy move, Casey." But yeah, really, really lovely with that. In terms of that prologue, so we often on the show, our agents say to people, don't put in prologues because people use prologues that don't do heavy lifting. Whereas I agree with your editor, this book needed that prologue. And as well, what you've done here, Riley, is you haven't necessarily done a complete dual timeline narrative where the past and the present gets equal play. We are mostly in the past, and then we have these sort of vignettes, these little flashbacks to the present to kind of move the past story forward. How did you decide on that balance?
Well, I going in this book, because there was so much that needed to be, so much table setting, so to speak, in the beginning, like just the layout of the lake, the layout of the houses, like where they are in position to each other, who lives there, what they do. And so I knew it was going to be a while before Catherine disappeared. So like the technically the inciting incident of the book I knew might be like past page 100, which you really shouldn't do. And so I knew that there had to be ways to keep the tension going. And so that's when I thought of like the before and after structure, and to just show you glimpses of things that are happening later, to just tantalizing, suspenseful things. And then, you know, bring it over where the before becomes now and the after. And so it was a lot of fun to like mess around with the timeline and do that kind of, I love it when TV shows do that, where they just give you a hint of, oh, and by the way, 2 weeks later, this is the situation. And you're like, how did they get to that situation? And it's a great, great trick to use. And I encourage all suspense writers to like mess around with like timelines.
Yeah, it was especially effective here. And in terms of the unreliable narrator, you know, what makes them, I have a theory that what makes unreliable narrators so unappealing is that we are all the unreliable narrators of our own lives. You know, I have a joke with my husband that when he starts to use the passive voice, I know he's being an unreliable narrator. So he will say, "The chicken is not cooked," as opposed to, "I did not cook the chicken," whatever. So the minute you use that passive voice, you're like, oh, you're avoiding the subject of the sentence. So what are you hiding from me? So, you know, what do you think makes an unreliable narrator so interesting in stories?
Well, you're right. We are all like unreliable narrators in our own way. And it's such a common trope now in books, especially psychological thrillers, that in some ways, you know, I'm always reluctant to do it. Like with Casey, you had to do it. And I don't, she is unreliable, but she's not lying to you necessarily. She's just sometimes ignoring the truth. And so I do think that's, you know, interesting. Some narrators just flat out will be like, tell the reader something that's completely untrue. In Casey's case, she's just skipping over some very vital information. And that made it a little bit more interesting and fun for me. Like, I don't know if I would ever fully go into the unreliable narrator, I am Amy Dunn from Gone Girl, completely lying to you, the reader, about literally everything. I don't think I would do that. but it works very well in some cases for other writers.
Yeah, no, it was subtly done and it was lovely. And just on something you said earlier, you know, you said your inciting incident came like 100 pages in. For our listeners who are going, Bianca, you keep telling us the inciting incident needs to be in the first three chapters. Here's the thing, Riley actually had two inciting incidents, which, because remember, at the beginning of the story, we need to answer the why now, why today question. Why is the story beginning now? Why is it not beginning later? So yes, the true inciting incident is Catherine's disappearance. But we have a mini inciting incident when Casey is sent by her mother to go live at the house because of things that she has done and her mother's concerned about her. I don't want to give those things away. But, you know, that answers the why now, why today question so that Casey is there when Catherine goes missing. So if you're going to make your big inciting incident come later, you still need a smaller inciting incident to explain to us why the story begins when it does. Riley, our time is up. It's been such a joy chatting with you. Thank you so, so much for joining us. For our listeners, you must read The House Across the Lake. We will link to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. Just a masterclass in maintaining suspense and tension. And, you know, in terms of these kind of morally ambiguous characters, and it just really keeps you turning pages. We wish you much luck with it, Riley, and hope to have you back for the next one.
Definitely. Thank you. This was so much fun. I love talking about shit no one tells other writers.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.